MBSFM.com presents Blind Line with Jonathan Mosen, where the world turns on, surfs in, and speaks out.
Welcome to Blind Line. This is Jonathan Mosen, and it is here in New Zealand, Sunday the 7th of November, still the 6th Universal Time, of course. Well, in the last week since we last spoke, it's been a bit of a disastrous week for New Zealand rugby. Not only did we lose the World Cup semi-finals against France, big time, but we also lost the playoff for third place with South Africa. Nasty stuff. The country's in depression.
Stop it. Yes. Stop it. I can't take any more. Stop it.
But we are doing our best to muddle on. For me on the campaign trail, it's been an extremely busy week with the campaign really in full swing now. And hence, and thus, this program is actually recorded. As the program goes to air, I am at a campaign meeting, which has been organised by a Christian group. So, here we are then, and my guest this week on the Blind Line Show is Stephen Bennett from New Zealand, a student of Massey University who is about to leave that wonderful institution. Stephen is the first blind person in New Zealand to do the rehabilitation course that allows him to work as an orientation and mobility instructor or a travel instructor. And this is all very exciting. There's a lot of interest in this. For years, the O&M industry in this country and, of course, in many parts of the world have been saying that blind people not only shouldn't be but can't be O&M instructors. It's a trend that I'm pleased to say a number of blind people are challenging successfully. So welcome to the program, Stephen.
Thank you very much.
What made you decide to go into a profession which so many people say a blind person can't and shouldn't be involved in?
Well, firstly, I have to say that my first move into the profession was not terribly brave. My first desire was to go and train in the States, in Ruston, Louisiana, with the National Federation of the Blind, among people who did believe that blind people could do it. So initially I was wanting to go and train where it was believed in. When that became impossible through lack of funding, it was then that I thought, right, I still want to do this, and if the only place I can do it is in New Zealand, among people who probably don't believe it can be done, then that's what I'll have to do.
And were there any barriers that you had to face in terms of getting acceptance into the course to allow you to pursue that?
Well, no, it was a bit frightening. I originally thought, sure, they're going to accept me. They probably, my instinct was to think that they probably have to accept me. I mean, there's human rights laws in this country. It might look bad if they don't, but they'll probably just accept me, put me through the course, and then maybe, you know, perhaps find a way of not employing me at the end, or making some noise as if I didn't make a very good job of the course. Well, I don't know whether that was the original intention. I don't think it was on the part of the lecturer, the person actually providing the instruction, but it may have been in the minds of other people. So I don't really know about that. But really, no, there weren't any barriers. They just said, well, if you're a reasonably good traveller yourself, come and do the course.
What motivated you to actually decide that you wanted to teach other blind people how to travel?
I think it was, I've always just got a huge buzz out of going places without having to rely on someone else. It's something that maybe other people take for granted, and the way I take it for granted too, but it still just gives me a huge great boost when I when I can sort of plan, make a few phone calls, maybe get some directions and then just go, or catch a bus and go to a place I've never been to before and finally end up at a destination. It just gives me, I mean, even just going for a walk, I just love walking around with a white cane, just going where I want to go because I want to go there, and not having to ask anybody for permission or for help, or not have to decide I can't go there because there's no one to give me some help. It just gives me a big buzz, and I think I just got to the stage where I wanted to pass that on to other people. And once again, it was through contact with NFB literature and the writings and speeches of Kenneth Jernigan, I think had a lot to do with me wanting to pass this on to other people, because I'd always enjoyed being independent myself, but I think coming into contact with Kenneth Jernigan's writings and speeches had a lot to do with wanting to pass that on to other people.
Do you think that good orientation skills are something that you're born with or something that can be taught?
Well, I think they can be taught. I think that it's a long process. If you weren't fortunate enough to acquire them at an early age, it's a long process. But if a person has the desire, then I believe they can be taught, and there are this purely mechanical exercises that people can do and can practice to improve orientation.
Can you give me an example of some of those?
Not without doing a lot of research. There are simple things like learning to turn 90 degrees, and actually, you know, like turn what you think is 90 degrees and make sure it is. So you can, for example, another person can hold up a hand, and you can hold up your hand and turn round, and the hand can be in such a position that if you have turned 90 degrees, the two hands slap together. The client and the instructor, or it doesn't even have to be a client and an instructor, it's just two people practicing. That sort of thing. That's just one example that comes to mind. But obviously, and I think the acquisition of orientation does have there's a lot to do with things that happen in early childhood. The time when the person actually loses vision, and how much they've actually seen before they lose vision, even at a young age. But yes, the long and the short of it is that I believe it can be taught.
I don't know whether this came up in your studies or whether you have a view on it, but it seems to me that a lot of the orientation and mobility that's taught in this country seems to be specific routes that people need to take, as opposed to the techniques that they can apply to find their own way to an unlimited number of destinations.
Oh yes, that there's a lot of that. A lot of that happens, and a lot of it in this country is to do with just that there is not enough time. The instructors don't feel that they have enough time. I mean, the funding isn't there to give them enough time with a blind or visually impaired person to teach the techniques that will enable that person to do their own route planning and make their own decisions, and they're just forced by sheer lack of funding to teach a few specific destinations. But I'm sure the instructors realise that that's not the best. However, there could be a lot in this to do with what the instructors expect can be done by the clients. And I like to think, as a blind person, that I may have perhaps higher expectations of the people I work with, that in fact they can learn techniques, particularly older people. And it's particularly older people that we're talking about here. The textbooks tend to say that older people, perhaps over 60, over 70 even, really aren't interested in going to all sorts of new places. They've just got a few places that they want to go to. Now, I'm not sure that that's true, and I'm, you know, hopefully going to start from the perspective that in fact that they can. And I think if I as the instructor believe that they can do this and can do it well and successfully, that actually might rub off onto the client, and they might get the idea that yes, I can, and that might translate into, okay, so let's do it.
How did you feel about being in a class where you're the only blind person and people are studying blind people? In other words, studying people like you and reading textbooks that make all kinds of assumptions. Was that a bit of a weird process?
It was a weird process. I didn't find that so much in the O&M, but I did have to learn stuff about techniques of daily living, and I found it in that I found the textbook for that very hard to read. I found it almost degrading to read it. And funnily enough, I think that the textbook was actually written by a couple of people who have themselves are low vision people, but not so much in the O&M. I guess because that was more very very practical, and we're actually getting out there and doing this stuff. But yes, in some respects, I did find the textbooks hard to take in that way.
And when you were in these classes, did you actually ever say, "Well, this isn't how it is for me as a blind person"?
Yes, I did. I did quite often. I did quite often say that. There were many times, however, that the textbook was making it clear that there's a difference between people who have lost their vision as adults and people who have lost their vision, or who maybe never had vision or lost it in infancy. So I had to remember that too, and I did learn some valuable lessons during the year of study, because I haven't had a lot to do with people who have lost their sight as adults, and if I have, I haven't had the chance to sit down and really find out what it was like for them, and going through the whole process of actually losing something and then having to gain new techniques and new outlook on life.
So has it changed your perspective on blindness at all?
No, it hasn't, but it has challenged me to actually learn to apply that perspective to people who have actually experienced a loss, who know what it's like to have lived life as sighted people and now have to know what it's like to live life as blind people, or as visually impaired people. And so, that's really the answer to that. It hasn't changed my basic perspective. My natural instinct is to feel that blindness is a characteristic, rather than what you might call a disability. But it may be that that there's perhaps a challenge in it's even more of a challenge for a person to adopt that philosophy if they have experienced the characteristic of sight.
How do you actually work on giving people that perspective of blindness?
My first instinct is to just be myself and believe that will come through in the end. There's a lot. I think there's a lot more as far as actually passing on anything like a philosophy. You know, I think about 95% of it is actually being around people who have that philosophy, and about 5% is actually talking about it. So I just like to think that my whole attitude to even a small thing like my whole attitude to a thing perhaps like what happens when you're wandering down the street and you maybe come in contact with a rubbish bin and the cane makes a hell of a noise on the rubbish bin and you feel like you've drawn attention to yourself and half the world's looking at you and either feeling sorry for you or thinking that you look a bit clumsy. That my attitude to that, because it's going to happen to me while I'm out there with the client, will perhaps rub off on the client and that there's much more I think involved in actually allowing a person to observe my attitudes than actually sitting down and preaching to them.
So how does it work in practice? Let's say, for instance, that as a new MP, I have to get round the massive parliamentary complex, and you're the O&M instructor assigned to that case. What happens?
Well, I would go there by myself, see what I can find out about the place by myself. If it turns out that I just for the sake of sheer time efficiency need a pair of eyes to tell me about some parts of the building, or then I would I could do that with a volunteer. It could be a friend or family member that I've got access to that I might just need for, and I'd only need them for say 20 minutes, or it could be a volunteer whom I've trained to do this. But once again, all I really need is their eyes. I don't need them to have any expertise. I don't need them to tell me my job. It's my job to know what questions to ask them, and I actually did this more than once during my training, and I did it completely independently of the lecturer. He told all four of us, you have to familiarize a student with the shopping center. So I just got on one occasion I did it with a completely untrained person of reasonable intelligence and reasonable eyesight, and asked them the questions, and they told me the answers, and then I did the job. Another occasion I used somebody in the class who did obviously have some knowledge of the O&M field, but I didn't need to have someone with knowledge. And so I've actually done this, and this is the strategy that I would use. Some things I can work out by myself, asking people in the Parliament building. If you were in Parliament, I could ask people in the Parliament building for the information. I may get the information from them as to the layout of the place, how many floors it has, that sort of thing. And I may be able to do it myself with that information. It may be that if I have to get a sighted person involved, but they don't have to be a specialist. I ask them the questions, they tell me what they can see, and I work from there.
Presumably then, you know, a competent blind traveller could use the sighted person exactly the same way and bypass the O&M instructor altogether.
Absolutely, and this is the way that I've conducted myself throughout my life. I've had very little O&M training myself from instructors. And these are the things that blind people are doing every day without anybody, teaching them. But and that's what I think O&M instruction is all about. I want to show other blind people, if they haven't actually experienced this kind of thing before, how I, as a blind person, solve these problems, and that's what they're going to observe me going into a completely strange environment and asking the right questions and finding out the landmarks and doing all those things which blind people are doing every day without anybody telling them how to do it.
It could be said that O&M is actually just nothing but a pseudoscience. That rehabilitation agencies are taking advantage of the insecurities of blind people, feeling that they need some professional, that blindness is such a complex business, when in fact, as you say, if they just had the confidence to ask a competent pair of eyes, they could figure it out for themselves. Are you in fact, as a soon-to-be O&M instructor, taking money raised in the name of the blind in somewhat false pretenses?
Well, I don't believe so. I think there's a lot of money spent on a lot of scientific stuff that is not necessary. But that doesn't mean that the O&M instructor is not necessary. It's most people, and I'm really talking about people who have lost their vision as adults. No doubt if they spent enough time with other blind people in peer support situations, they could in the end come up with good strategies to get themselves around, but that's leaving too much to chance. I wish there was more of that going on. I wish that there was no need for O&M instructors, but I'm convinced that there is, and it's too important to leave this to chance, that a given person, just by rubbing shoulders with other blind people who have been around the traps a bit longer, gets to hear about certain strategies and gets to put them into practice. Working with an O&M instructor for 7 or 8 weeks or longer, hopefully we can, you know, get people moving about independently a lot quicker.
So there's a mentoring function.
Well, there is with me. I don't know.
It almost makes a very powerful argument that all O&M instructors should actually be blind people.
Well, yes, I mean, it does. I have to say that I'm quite impressed with I'm impressed with the fact that the sighted people that I went through the course with spent an awful lot of time under blindfold wandering around with a cane, and so to a certain extent, just purely in terms of travel, they have actually been there and done that, and they've crashed into poles, and they've wandered across streets with traffic whistling around their ears, and known what it's like to be a bit intimidated, and they've done that. Of course, they've taken the blindfold off at the end of the lesson, and gone around the rest of their lives being sighted. So it doesn't teach them what it's like to be blind, but it does teach them what it's like to travel around with a cane without sight. And so they have something to offer, I suppose, in a mentoring kind of way, but in a very limited way. And in theory, at least, I would think that a good blind O&M instructor is better than a good sighted O&M instructor.
It seems to me that it will be inevitable that at some point you're going to get someone who says, I don't want a blind O&M instructor teaching me, I don't feel comfortable with it, I don't feel happy with it. How will you feel about that, and how will you deal with it?
I have thought about this. My first reaction is to say, well, that's their right, and that's their right, and they shouldn't have to work with anybody that they don't want to work with. It may be that we get to a point where people are going to have the choice and say, I don't want to work with a sighted instructor.
Yes, and of course, generally client choice about particular instructors is respected, and you're right. I mean, you may find that your caseload is huge simply because of the demand of working with a blind person.
Well, yes, and hopefully we'll get to the stage where there's heaps more blind O&M instructors, and so this problem might arise in a big way.
So, with your sympathies for the NFB philosophy, have you found that anything that they've tried to teach you at the somewhat conventional rehab course that you've done has conflicted with those views?
Their philosophy does tend to, I mean, they're not going to sit down and teach you that blindness is a characteristic, and that they basically come from the philosophy that blindness is a disability which can be a handicapping condition, and so since they come from a completely different philosophical standpoint, you know, there's a whole difference in the flavour of the literature. In practice, not terribly often, and as I say, I was there to learn. It'll only be in the next year or two that I'll be able to really absorb the whole system that I've been exposed to, absorb both systems, and come to a balance. But in practice there weren't too many things, and a lot of what they were saying, as I say, what was concerned with working with older people with whom I've had very little experience, and people who have lost their sight as adults, once again people with whom I've had very little experience. So I was prepared to put myself in the position of a learner, and to listen and think hard before I made too many objections.
Are you expecting any resistance from O&M instructors who will soon be fellow staff members?
Yes, I'm expecting it, and I'll just expect that my performance in the job will be such that a reasonable person, a person with a reasonably open mind, will see that I'm getting the job done. There will be those who will not have an open mind, because I will do things in a way that's different from the textbook, because I'll be doing things, achieving the same results but by a different route, there will be those who will therefore conclude that I'm not doing the job properly, and you will always get that. But I'll just have to live with those people and work alongside them as best I can. And my challenge is to believe in myself, and to be confident in my ability to perform, and to not allow myself to be mentally shaken by people who are wanting to be closed-minded.
Are there not certain safety factors in some situations? For instance, when you're on a really busy road and it might be difficult to actually hear, because of the traffic sound, what the client is doing with the cane. Also things like monitoring the arc of the cane, to check that they're sufficiently covering themselves to avoid running into some obstacle or falling down some hole, or even the fact that they might get themselves into a situation where they encounter some really lethal obstacle or pothole or something that you didn't know was there.
You've covered about three things there that are all different and would each need their own explanation. But very quickly, I developed the technique of actually, if it gets difficult to hear going across busy streets, I simply lightly put a hand on the client's back. So I'll always know where they are. That until I can actually teach the client to use a good healthy tap of the cane going across a street. Once I've got the client into the habit of tapping the cane fairly solidly when going across busy streets, then I won't need to maintain that sort of manual contact and can step back a little. But if in doubt, that technique is always available to me. Yes, there is the thing of a lot of time it's better to let the client go in front of me, so they might come across things that I haven't where I haven't been before them. However, in most situations, you teach the client in a controlled environment, in other words, an environment that you're familiar with, and so I would generally go and explore an environment before the lesson, so that I've actually been there. As for the arc, there are ways of teaching that without sight. I've had lengthy descriptions from an O&M instructor in Nebraska called Jeff Altman, who some of the American listeners may be familiar with. He's got methods of doing that. I developed methods for doing that which satisfied my sighted instructor, and so there are ways of doing that. As for the monitoring that they're continuing to use a good arc, it's a case of self-monitoring, just continually reminding the person, how's that arc of yours? You know, are you making sure you've got coverage? I can actually hear that coverage anyway. I can hear that they're using a good arc by walking behind them. But you see, in the end, this is the thing about a blind O&M instructor. You encourage the student to monitor their own arc and their own, whether their hand is centered and that sort of thing, because of course one day you're not going to be there, and if you can teach the client to self-monitor, then you're going a long way to making that person a good traveler when you're not there. And this is perhaps a failing that we have with sighted instructors, who are their instinct is to say, your arc's too narrow, you know, fix it up. But one day that instructor won't be there. So encouraging the self-monitoring is a vital, I think, a real advantage of a blind O&M instructor.
So where are you at in all of this, and what happens from here on in?
The next step is that in about 10 days I go to Dunedin, down the southern end of the South Island of New Zealand, New Zealand's fourth largest city, and do what they call a practicum, which is just 3 months of where I work with an existing O&M instructor employed by the Royal New Zealand Foundation for the Blind. The first few weeks of that I will be observing that person doing their job, and gradually I will be given more and more responsibility for actually taking lessons and working with clients under the supervision of that person, and then they obviously decide whether I come up to the mark.
Well, very best of luck. And it sounds like a wonderful thing that you've done, and I hope others can follow in your example. And what about the rugby then?
What about the rugby? What's rugby?
I see.
You want to? What's that game? It's a game of some kind, isn't it? I've heard of it.
He's in a bad way, and it's very typical of how we are in this country at the moment. That's it for this week's Blind Line. As I said, for those of you who tuned in late, I'm out campaigning this morning. I am standing for Parliament, and the election is on November the 27th, so things are pretty busy at the moment. So there's no live talk portion today. We'll do our best to see if we can provide one for you next Sunday or Saturday Universal Time, but I can't guarantee it. And thanks for coming on the programme, Stephen.
It's been my pleasure.